The Reina nightclub entrance is covered in a blue tarp with a large Turkish flag laid over it. A knot of TV reporters shivers in the cold across the street. A man who works in a parking lot just a few yards away doesn't want to give his name, but says simply, it was a massacre. Sadly, he says, we're getting used to it. Every 10 or 15 days, something blows up in this country. How can we work? This is the end of work. He says, I know our security forces are on alert and people are trying to be careful, but what can you do when some guy just hides a gun and goes on a rampage? They can't do anything. It happens in all kinds of neighborhoods, not just here. It's hard to believe, but we're getting used to this. Police have been going through the crime scene looking for evidence that might help them catch the attacker and answer some basic questions, such as, was there only one gunman, as officials believe? If all the bullets in the nightclub were fired from the same weapon, for instance, that might help answer that question. Security camera footage appears to show a man dressed in black shooting and entering the club, and different footage showed an attacker inside wearing different clothes. The interior minister says the attacker changed clothes before fleeing, one of many unanswered questions. For people here, another question is, when will these bloody attacks stop? The government's calling for unity, but people were still recovering from last month's explosion at a soccer stadium just down the road from here, and then the shocking assassination of Russia's ambassador in Ankara, and now this.
A grim scene there, clearly. What are we learning at this hour, Peter, about how Turkey may respond to this attack?
Well, if this claim of responsibility by ISIS does hold up, one question would be, is there a connection to Turkey's military operations against the group in northern Syria? We might see at least a continuation of those strikes, if not an escalation. We're seeing claims of that escalation already. There was a security meeting here yesterday. President Erdogan is promising the fight against terrorism will continue without let-up. And today, Turkish media are reporting joint Turkish and Russian airstrikes against ISIS targets inside northern Syria, they say hitting more than 100 locations. So basically, the government's been taking a very hard line against what it calls an array of terrorist enemies. I mean, this includes not just ISIS, but Kurdish militants, both in Turkey and Syria. Far-left groups, supporters of the cleric Fethullah Gulen. He's been blamed for last summer's failed coup attempt, which he denies. So it looks like there's been no big shift in policies, and a hard response is what's coming.
I mean, Peter, you've been in Istanbul now for several years. Can you just take a step back briefly and describe to us how Turkey has changed?
Well, when I arrived in 2010, Turkey was still being hailed as a model for the Middle East, a functioning, economically strong democracy run by pious Muslim leaders. In the years that followed, it's been crisis after crisis, both involving internal politics and outside forces. And these days, Turkey's seen as having an increasingly authoritarian leader. Its involvement in Syria has made it a target of ISIS. Mm. There's a war with Kurdish militants going on. And of course, that failed coup attempt. So yes, big changes indeed.
NPR's Peter Kenyon reporting from Istanbul. Thanks so much, Peter.
Thanks, Rachel.
Democrats may have lost the House and the Senate over the past 8 years, but they always had one thing, President Barack Obama and his veto pen in the White House. On January 20th, Republicans will find themselves with all the power in Washington for the first time since 2006. As NPR's Scott Detrow reports, the Capitol's new power dynamic is forcing Democrats to make some tough strategic choices about how they're going to work as a minority party.
The starting point in the conversation Democrats are having with themselves right now is this. Republicans in Congress spent almost all of the past 8 years opposing President Obama, and they seem to have reaped a lot of political rewards for the bloc opposition. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is quick and careful to reject that approach.
We always, always trying to find a place where we can find a common goal, giving them credit or saving face or whatever it happens to be.
But when Pelosi and other Democrats talk about working with Trump, that common goal is conditional. They say Trump would have to be willing to do things they care about, like maybe follow through on a promise to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on infrastructure projects. But otherwise, Democrats are confident that drawing out their differences with the new president will be a winning strategy.
But our big leverage is the public.
Differences on things like not changing Medicare and Social Security. That's the exact playbook that worked well for Pelosi in 2005 and 2006, when Democrats ended up winning back control of Congress. It's why, while Republicans are talking about repealing Obamacare, Incoming Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer is warning about Medicare.
Republicans here in Washington are gearing up for a war on seniors, and they shall not, they must not prevail.
Schumer says Senate Democrats will give one heck of a hearing to Tom Price, Trump's pick for the Department of Health and Human Services. Democrats think they can generate a lot of positive headlines by grilling Trump's cabinet picks. Here's Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut.
These are, with a few exceptions, radical nominees, the likes of which we have never seen in the history of this country.
Cabinet confirmations, they say, will be a way to keep emphasizing the things they've been criticizing Trump for, like not releasing his tax returns. But highlighting contrasts can only go so far when Republicans set the congressional agenda. At some point, Democrats still face a choice. Do they do their best to block every single big initiative, or try to work with Republicans to make it more Democrat-friendly? Sarah Binder studies Congress at the Brookings Institution.
On most measures, whether it's spending bills, deregulation, repeal Dodd-Frank, that all requires cooperation from at least 8 Democrats, and that's hard to see. So I think Democrats do have leverage.
The hardest political calculus could be Obamacare. Republicans can repeal it without any Democratic votes, but they need Democratic support in the Senate to pass a replacement plan. Many Democrats might want to work with Republicans to keep as much of Obamacare as they can, but helping give Trump a big legislative accomplishment could make him more popular, and it could anger progressive activists. Just listen to Michael Moore, appearing on a CNN show hosted by Van Jones.
It is the responsibility of this minority of Democrats in Congress
to
block, obstruct, disrupt, and do whatever they can.
Nancy Pelosi knows Democrats all across the country are anxious, but she's urging patience as the party tries to make its case to voters.
Somebody used the analogy of it's like telling somebody they married the wrong person or their art is fake.
The first scenario is something many people have seen happen to a friend or family member. The second, maybe not as much. Still, Pelosi says it doesn't help when you're the one who breaks the bad news.
They bought it. They'll find out sooner or later whether they made a mistake.
Pelosi has seen voters reject Democrats, come back to the party, and then reject them again. She says she is patient enough. Democrats will continue to point out the key differences between the parties and wait for voters to eventually come back. Scott Detrow, NPR News.
This is NPR News. It is 8:18 and it is 2017, and I hope you're having a wonderful day. Thank you so much for starting it with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, it's the latest headlines from NPR and WPR. We'll talk about how some people in the medical community want to address a projected doctor shortage. That story from WPR's Shemaine Mills in a couple of minutes.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
In this celebration of the Christmas season, WPR is pleased to support cultural celebrations from around the world. More information at WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Police in Turkey are still searching for the gunman who killed 39 people on New Year's morning at a nightclub in Istanbul. Islamic State claims responsibility for the attack. ISIS says it was also responsible for today's car bombing in Iraq that killed at least 22 people that happened in Baghdad's Sadr City neighborhood. Crowds are lining the streets of Pasadena, California this morning for the annual Rose Parade. Ben Bergman with member station KPCC says security has been stepped up.
Workers added water-filled barricades at more than 50 intersections to block vehicles from driving onto the parade route. More than 1,000 police are patrolling city streets along with dozens of bomb-sniffing dogs. Officials said they don't know about any specific threats to the Rose Parade, which is in its 128th year.
Democrat Roy Cooper has been sworn in as North Carolina's governor, NPR's Sarah McCammon reports.
Cooper took the oath of office just after midnight as the new year began. He'll participate in a public inaugural this Saturday. Cooper is coming in amidst a lot of political turmoil in North Carolina over issues including a controversy over which restrooms transgender people should use. Cooper, who's a Democrat, unseated Republican Governor Pat McCrory after a partial recount showed Cooper won by about 10,000 votes.
There is no trading today on Wall Street. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. A projected doctor shortage in Wisconsin is spurring efforts to expand the duties of other medical professionals. Physician assistants, or PAs, currently diagnose and treat patients under the supervision of doctors. They may seek changes to state law in the upcoming year to expand their duties. Shemaine Mills reports.
PAs have been around for a long time. The profession began after a doctor shortage in the 60s, according to Eric Elliott. He's president-elect of the Wisconsin Academy of Physician Assistants.
So we're no stranger to team-based approach, but for it to work going into the future, we have to kind of identify the limitations and barriers.
Elliott says one of the barriers is that a doctor can only supervise four PAs. He says many PAs graduate and leave Wisconsin for other states where they have more autonomy. A group representing doctors says it's waiting to see what a proposal for expanded PA duties would entail. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
More than 9,000 ballots in Wisconsin were not counted correctly among the 3 million tallied on election night last November. That's according to the Wisconsin State Journal, which says another 2,100 votes were randomly thrown out during the recent recount, so the total votes could match the number of people signing poll books. The newspaper's review found that human errors by either voters or election officials caused most of the discrepancies, including one type of voting machine. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from ADP, committed to helping businesses build better, more productive workforces with payroll and HR solutions that combine software with human insights and expertise. ADP, a more human resource. More at ADP.com. From Stitch Fix, a personal styling service for women and men that has users fill out a style quiz with their taste, budget, and style preferences. The stylists learn what customers like before sending hand-picked clothes. Learn more at stitchfix.com. From Whole Foods Market, committed to offering food with no artificial colors, no artificial flavors, no artificial preservatives, and no artificial sweeteners. Peak season produce, meat, fish, and kitchen staples, available at Whole Foods Market. And from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. Freelance journalist Austin Tice was taken captive in Syria in August of 2012. Aside from a video released 5 weeks after his capture, his parents have not seen or heard from him since. However, they've been given new information recently that's giving them new reasons to hope for his safe return in 2017. Austin's parents, Deborah and Mark Tice, recently met with President Obama's envoy for hostage affairs, a man named James O'Brien. I asked Mark and Deborah to tell us what they could about their conversation with him.
What he shared with us was what Senator John Cornyn shared, which is that it's the assessment of the United States government that Austin, our son, is alive, that he's still being held captive in Syria. And for that reason, we continue to ask our government and others to do everything they can to bring him home.
Senator John Cornyn, we should say, who's also been instrumental in working on this. So you know that he's alive.
That means a lot, Rachel, just exactly the way that you just said it.
Yeah, we've never had any doubt. We have been confident from the time he first went missing, but it's fantastically uplifting to hear that same word from people in our government that can make that assessment and share that with us.
I understand that all these conversations are sensitive, but do you know any more about who is holding Austin? I mean, we've seen reports attributed to Reporters Without Borders that say Austin is not being held by ISIS, and there is some hint that his captors may be allied with the Syrian government. What can you tell us?
We can't tell you much, Rachel. You know, the most important thing that the bottom of that question, the question that you're asking behind that is, you know, what can be done on their end to resolve this situation and bring Austin safely home? But what we need is for those that are holding Austin to reach out and to let us know what needs to be done to bring him safely home.
Because you don't really know what his captors are demanding because you haven't been able to engage at that level of communication.
Exactly.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, in the same way that we have been asking our government to do everything it can, we continue to reach out in whatever way we can, including this broadcast, to the Syrian government to ask them to do everything they can to locate Austin, do everything possible, and hopefully work with our government to bring him home.
I understand you also met with President Obama this past summer. What was his message to you?
He assured us that it is a priority for him, that he is committed to doing this, that should it become necessary, because we met with him in July, that he would brief the incoming administration and make sure that Austin's return remained a high priority.
How have you two managed your own expectations, especially in light of this most recent news, this belief that Austin is alive? How do you internalize that and keep your expectations in check, I guess?
No, not at all. We don't try to contain our expectations or mitigate our hope or anything like that. We keep the light on. We keep the sheets clean. You know, we keep the refrigerator stocked so that when he walks in the door, we will be so ready to just hug him and get on with the next thing. What about you, Mark?
You know, Austin's an extraordinary individual, even as I say that as his father. And so I have a lot of confidence in his strength of mind, his strength of spirit and heart, and just looking forward to that big hug when he gets home.
Deborah and Mark Tice are the parents of journalist Austin Tice. And we should also note a large banner calling for Austin's safe return has been mounted in front of the museum here in Washington, D.C. The banner will stay there until Austin Tice is returned safely to his family. Deborah and Mark, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Rachel. And we wish you all the best in the new year.
With all of us, know that we are wishing for Austin's safe return.
Thank you.
The relationship between a hairdresser and his or her clients can be an intimate one. Sometimes the conversation gets personal, and some stylists are used to seeing signs that their clients have been victims of abuse. There's a new law in Illinois that recognizes that unique relationship, and it now requires hairstylists and nail technicians to go through training about domestic violence as part of their licensing. Here's NPR's Maggie Penman.
It's a classic scene. You see it in movies and on TV. Women chatting with their hairstylist, talking about their love lives or problems at work, just like they're talking to an old friend. This new Illinois law wants to use those intimate relationships to get victims of domestic violence help.
It is an intimate relationship, and it's a wonderful relationship.
Joan Rowan has been a hairstylist for decades. She owns two salons, one in Oaklawn, Illinois, and the other on the south side of Chicago. She says she started putting pamphlets in the salon bathrooms with information and resources like the numbers for domestic violence hotlines.
I've had women, you know, when you're washing their head, it bumps on their head, or, you know, they ran into a door again. I've been a hairdresser for 41 years. One in three women have violence in their lives.
She's citing a statistic used by many domestic violence advocacy groups, including one called Chicago Says No More. This is the group that's designing the one-hour training for stylists. Christy Paskvin is the founder of that organization. She says she knows an hour-long training won't make anyone an expert or a therapist. The aim is just to educate the stylists and give them the tools to refer clients to resources that can help.
There's something like 88,000 salon professionals that will be trained in the next 2 years. That's 88,000 more individuals that'll be able to have conversations with family and friends and clients, and that raises awareness.
Salon professionals won't be required to intervene or held liable if they don't. Lawmakers hope to just get a little more information out there, even if it's just over a manicure. Maggie Penman, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
If Donald Trump's tough campaign promises about immigration become federal policy, it could mean a standoff with some big city mayors.
If the federal government wants our police officers to tear immigrant families apart, we will refuse to do it.
I'm Robert Siegel. The coming struggle over immigration later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Catch All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It is 8:30. Happy 2017. This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Maureen McCollum. Still to come this hour, last year saw a rise in anti-Muslim rhetoric in the U.S. We'll hear from the director of the Inner City Muslim Action Network, a nonprofit organization in Chicago, more about this in about 15 minutes. In Wisconsin news, Minnesota fisheries managers are concerned about the future for herring on Lake Superior. Minnesota Public Radio News reports that at a time when demand for the fish has increased, biologists worry not enough young herring are surviving. Commercial fishermen who ply the waters of Minnesota's North Shore have caught a lot fewer cisco or lake herring in recent years. Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Fisheries Chief Don Pereira says at least on the western arm of Lake Superior, the herring population is not in a healthy state. Milwaukee police are searching for suspects after a New Year's shooting at a nightclub killed one person, a violent start to a year that saw nearly 150 homicides in the city. WITI-TV reports the shooting happened just before 5 a.m. yesterday at Dee's Elegance Bar and Grill on Milwaukee's northwest side. Police say the 37-year-old victim was shot inside the club after an altercation with at least two people. Those two fled the shooting. The victim died at the scene. It's Milwaukee's first homicide of 2017. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports a man who was found fatally shot Friday became the city's 142nd homicide victim of last year. About 80% of Milwaukee's homicides last year were shooting deaths. This is WPR News.
Support for WPR is provided by the WHA Radio Arts Programming Endowment Fund, providing funds to help WPR bring quality educational and entertainment programs, like A Prairie Home Companion, to Wisconsin Public Radio listeners.
Support for WGTD and NPR in Walworth County comes from Broggy Coffee House and Wine Bar in Williams Bay, offering live music, special events, local fine arts and crafts, and homemade specialty dishes. Details online at BroggyCoffeeWineMusicArt.com.
It'll be a cloudy day in Wisconsin. There's a chance of rain in the south and snow in the north with mixed precipitation in west central Wisconsin today. Highs will be in the low 30s in the northwest to the mid to upper 30s in southern and eastern Wisconsin. Tonight, that precipitation could continue into the evening.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Americans for the Arts. For more than half a century, committed to transforming America's communities through the arts and arts education, in partnership with local, state, and national leaders. Learn more at AmericansForTheArts.org. From ZipRecruiter, matching employers with active candidates from over 200 job sites, serving more than 1 million businesses in a variety of industries nationwide. Learn more at ZipRecruiter.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. Good morning. Today in your health, the future of the Affordable Care Act. On Wednesday, President Obama will meet with congressional Democrats about how to protect the health care reform plan that bears his name. Republican leaders have said they'll repeal Obamacare as soon as they take the reins in Washington. My co-host David Green spoke with NPR health policy correspondent Allison Kojak about the longstanding tension over this legislation.
In 2010, the Democrats kind of rammed through this law without any Republican support. It was huge, it was complicated, thousands of pages long. And ever since, Republicans have been pretty mad about how it passed, and they've refused to help fix it. And instead, they've just promised over and over again to repeal. And in fact, the House has already voted more than 60 times to do just that over the years.
And now they'll have a Republican president. Both houses in Republican control. Looks like it can happen. What exactly does it mean to repeal?
Well, they can't really repeal it outright because the Democrats in the Senate can filibuster that and block it. But Democrats can't filibuster anything that has to do with the budget. So what the Republicans probably will do is eliminate the financial parts of the law, the tax and budget items. But that means they'll eliminate the penalty for people who don't buy health insurance, and they'll eliminate the subsidies that help people pay for insurance under the law. That's really the core of the Affordable Care Act. So what's not clear is how quickly they're going to cut off the money. They're trying to come up with a replacement plan, and so they may delay that for months or even years.
So lack of clarity, delays could mean a lot of people left in limbo, I imagine.
Millions. Right now, the estimate's about 20 million people get their insurance through Obamacare, one way or another. You've got about 10 million people who buy plans through the exchanges that have been set up by the federal and state governments. And then there are millions more who have insurance because of the expansion of Medicaid under the law. About 31 states and D.C. have expanded Medicaid to people who have a little bit more money just over the poverty line. And a lot of that is in the Affordable Care Act and could be reversed as well.
Democrats have made the charge that people could be cut off if Republicans act very boldly and very quickly. Is that possible? Could Republicans literally cut people off who get insurance under this?
Well, I don't think that they want to. They have said over and over again, Republican leaders, that they have no intention of just throwing people off their insurance policies. But there's a lot that they have to consider. Before the Affordable Care Act, people with existing medical conditions, they often couldn't get any insurance, or they were very much priced out of the market. And there are also a whole group of people who had lifetime limits, like $1 million. And when you have a severe illness, you can reach that limit. So there's this whole slew of people who did not have insurance, and they're pretty happy with Obamacare that they can get coverage now.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are other people, like Will Denneke. I talked to him last October, just before he was going to start shopping for insurance for this year, and he was pretty mad because his costs were rising.
Incredibly, we got a notice from our healthcare company, Moda, which has had financial problems, saying that my premium was going up to $930.
So Denneke's self-employed, and unlike most people on Obamacare, he makes too much money to qualify for government subsidies. So before the ACA, he paid about $340 a month for insurance, but that's all changed.
I've had health insurance my whole life, but it's just offensive, you know, in principle, to think about spending $1,000 a month for healthcare insurance. I just don't make enough to, you know, to pay that kind of percent of my income on health insurance.
But on the other side of the equation, you have people like Lee Kvetko. She lives in Texas, and she takes about 10 medications every day because she's had two organ transplants. And after Obamacare passed, she was able to quit her job at a big company, start her own business because she could finally get her own insurance.
This particular plan, the fact that they cannot discriminate against me because of how I was born, was a lifesaver, literally.
Okay, so Allison Kojak, that voice right there is someone who really relied on this law because she had pre-existing conditions. She could make a big change, start her own company, and she would still get insurance. She wouldn't lose it.
Exactly, and that's who the law was really directed at in the first place, people like her.
Okay, so some of the things you talked about. Congress could come in, they could defund a lot of parts of this law. The president, you know, President Trump, once he comes in, will probably sign that. What happens next?
Well, if they vote to defund, all the money could go away to implement and support the law. But some elements stay in place, including the requirement that insurance companies cover people who have ongoing medical conditions, people like Lee Kvetko.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump has said over and over again that he wants to keep that provision because it's very popular. Here he is with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes just after the election.
When you replace it, are you going to make sure that people with preconditions are still covered?
Yes, because it happens to be one of the strongest assets.
You're going to keep that.
Also, with the children living with their parents for an extended period, we're going to try and keep that.
The problem with that is that some experts warn that the individual insurance market could collapse altogether if that part of the law is preserved, but young, healthy people stop paying for insurance because it gets too expensive.
Because there'd be less money in the system to actually support the people who need the insurance.
Exactly.
That's the argument the Democrats are making.
Exactly.
So do the Republicans have kind of a broad plan that would give us some idea of, you know, something comprehensive that would be replacing Obamacare?
Well, so what they have is they don't have legislative language. There's a lot of ideas out there. Various members of Congress have put out proposals, but they don't have a definitive plan, which is where this talk of delay comes in. They may vote to repeal but not cut off the money immediately while they come up with their replacement plan. But included in those ideas, there are some general principles. One is that instead of requiring people to buy insurance, which is really unpopular, they would instead create incentives for people to buy insurance by offering tax credits toward your insurance premiums. But there's not a definitive proposal out there, and Republicans are talking about perhaps waiting years before they find a replacement to the Affordable Care Act.
All of which is to say you're going to be a very busy reporter covering all of this in this year and the coming
I'm
years.
I'm sure I will be.
All right. That's NPR's health policy correspondent, Allison Kojak. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks, David.
Support for your health comes from GNC, global provider of nutritional supplements, committed to helping customers improve their quality of life. More than 4,000 of its stores will reopen this month with new products and programs. Learn more at #OneNewGNC. And from 3M Health Information Systems and Verily, working to improve insights and outcomes across health delivery systems and patient populations. Learn more at 3M.com/pophealth.
Hey, Happy New Year, by the way. It's a new year. It's a good excuse to thank you for listening to Morning Edition on your local public radio station. You can talk to us on social media anytime. We're on Facebook, on Twitter. I'm at Rachel NPR. David is at NPR Green. You can find Steve at NPR Inskeep. Of course, we are at Morning Edition. And this is NPR News.
It's 8:41. Happy Monday. Happy 2017. Thanks for listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Up next, we'll be bringing you the latest news from NPR and WPR. And in 10 minutes on Morning Edition, turning the page to a new year with some life advice learned from the tech world. That story ahead in 20 minutes.
Next summer, WPR and Holiday Vacations, along with Morning Edition host and news reporter Maureen McCollum, are heading out west to see five national parks from Yellowstone to the Grand Canyon. Travelers will also listen to the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, tour Montezuma's Castle, and visit the Museum of the Rockies. More information on the trip is available at wpr.org/travel.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. ISIS says it carried out today's car bombing in Iraq that left at least 22 people dead. The explosion went off in Baghdad's Sadr City neighborhood hours after French President Francois Hollande arrived in the country. There's word of a deadly prison riot in Brazil. At least 50 people have been killed, mostly inmates. Others escaped. It took hours for guards to control the situation. In South Florida, seven people are recovering from their injuries after last night's shooting in a Miami-Dade neighborhood.
The seven people were standing outside of a residence when an unknown vehicle drove up, stopped, rolled down the windows, and proceeded to fire at the victim standing outside of the home.
That's Miami-Dade Police Detective Robin Pinkard, courtesy of WSVN Television. One of those wounded is in critical condition. There's no word on a possible motive. The new year means higher minimum wages for hourly workers in 19 states in the U.S. Paige Browning with member station KUOW has more from Seattle.
Washington State and Massachusetts see the highest state minimums, both at $11 an hour. Washington, D.C. increasing its minimum to $12.50. Over the next few years, we'll see states reach $15 minimum wages for the first time, including in Washington State, California, and New York.
There's no trading today on Wall Street because of the New Year holiday. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Wisconsin is in the top five states for the direct sales of food from producers. As Hope Kerwin reports, a new national survey found local food sales are strong for fresh and value-added products.
In 2015, Wisconsin farmers sold more than $430 million worth of food directly to consumers and local organizations. Wisconsin is fifth in the nation for the number of farms participating in direct food sales, behind California, Texas, New York, and Ohio. John Hendrickson is from UW-Madison's Center for Integrated Ag Systems. He says direct marketing through CSAs or farmers markets allows producers to receive the full retail value of their food.
Most producers feel that that is one of the best ways for them to try to remain or become profitable at what is usually a smaller scale of production.
Hendrickson says direct food sales have been going on for many years in Wisconsin. Recently, some are concerned too many farms are competing in larger cities like Madison. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
State lawmakers have been asked to once again give Wisconsin Circuit Court judges the authority to order the seizure of vehicles owned by repeat drunken drivers. That authority was taken away from judges in 2009 and replaced with a law that emphasized the use of ignition interlock devices. At the time, there were concerns about taking away the driver's ability to get to work. It reinforced the requirement the driver needed to be sober to operate the vehicle. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Audible, provider of audiobooks on topics ranging from astronomy to zombies. More information at audible.com/listen. Audible, stories that surround you. From discountmugs.com, with online design tools to enable individuals and businesses to print their message or logo on a variety of items, including drinkware, tote bags, and clothing. Learn more at discountmugs.com/NPR. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. There's been a lot of talk in the past year about hate crimes against minority groups. As we begin 2017, we wanted to hear how it feels to be a member of one of those groups being targeted right now, Muslim Americans. Ramina Shashibi leads a Chicago nonprofit called the Inner City Muslim Action Network. When we reached out to him, in our conversation, he brought up the San Bernardino shooting in December of 2015, when a Muslim couple shot and killed 14 people. Now, Shashibi told me a story about how that attack affected him from a distance. He said shortly after the shooting, he was in a park on the south side of Chicago with his kids.
As I typically always do with my children, when it comes time for one of the prayer times, I'll pray publicly. And I stood watching them play and became mindful of a couple of cars that were driving up. There was a moment where I paused, quite frankly, about whether or not this was the smartest thing to do. And one of my daughters caught me in that moment, and it was just an innocent question about why I was hesitating to pray. And
she was calling you out.
She was calling me out.
Now, Shashibi says for him, that moment illustrated the complexity of what it means to be a Muslim American in the age of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And at that time, the presidential election was just kicking into high gear.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
It was a refrain Trump repeated throughout the campaign. Last November, he also suggested that all Muslims in the country be included in some kind of government registry. But Nashashibi worries that singling out individuals based on their religion is tantamount to calling all Muslims terrorists.
I get it. ISIS does effectively co-opt, appropriate parts of the Islamic tradition. There's no doubt. I mean, we see that, unfortunately, in all religious traditions. But I think the question for us is not to be blinded or naive to what is happening across the globe, but when it comes to language, language matters. Yeah. And what my 10-year-old daughter and my 7-year-old daughter and my 5-year-old son grow up seeing on CNN, you know, Muslim terrorists, that matters. That has profound psychological effects on children.
We've seen all kinds of people go to Trump Tower to bend the president-elect's ear on a variety of issues. If you were granted 15 minutes with the next president, what would you say?
On some level, I think I would say that whipping up the worst of the sentiments of America, using fear to mobilize people at the end of the day will come back to haunt us, all of us, and that our community is not going to simply settle for being passive victims. In this administration, we are going to organize, we are going to mobilize, and we're going to make sure our voices are heard.
Ramina Shashibi is the founder of the Inner City Muslim Action Network based in Chicago. Rami, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Rachel.
This is NPR News.
It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in this morning, and don't go anywhere. Classical music does start in a little over 10 minutes. We'll hear from Peter Bryant filling in for Stephanie Elkins this morning.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Katy Park's annual Ice Fishing Derby will take place the morning of January 21st. The event gives kids the opportunity to ice fish with experienced adults, as well as join in special activities including snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, and hiking.
The playing field is leveled by free access to information, providing an essential public service. This is NPR.
Cloudy day today in Wisconsin. There is a chance of rain in the south and snow in the north with mixed precipitation in west central Wisconsin. Highs today will be in the low 30s in the northwest to the mid and upper 30s in the south and in the east. Tonight, a chance that mixed precipitation could continue throughout the night. Temperatures down to the 20s and 30s.
Support for WPR comes from Sustainable Engineering Group, discovering solutions to reduce energy usage in healthcare, education, airports, and office buildings. More at sustainENG.com. Sustainable Engineering Group, your high-performance building partner.
WGTD is an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio and NPR. A cultural asset and a community resource, WGTD is owned and operated by Gateway Technical College with additional financial support from the Wisconsin Public Radio Association and local underwriters whose customers value public radio.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. At one time or another, many of us feel stuck. Stuck in the wrong job, the wrong relationship, maybe the wrong city. NPR's social science correspondent Shankar Vedantam has a story today about one possible solution that comes from Silicon Valley.
After more than a decade of working in education administration, Christine Metzger awoke one day and realized she wasn't the person she wanted to be. She found what seemed like just the change she needed, a new job at a boarding school in England. She quit her job, sold her belongings, and prepared to embark on her new life.
I was sleeping on an aero bed and had my three suitcases next to me. I was right about to leave Hoboken and be on my way. And I received a phone call from the folks in England saying, "We're really sorry, but we couldn't get you a work visa."
Instead of heading to England to start her new life, Christine found herself unemployed. The next job she found didn't have visa issues, but
it was a long process. And unfortunately, in the end, it turned out that the organization had a hiring freeze, and the board did not give permission to hire me.
Then the next position came, working for a nonprofit organization for the performing arts. This job she got.
And then another transition came, a little earlier than I anticipated.
Christine was downsized. In fact, on the day she and I talked,
"Today is my last day at the organization."
She couldn't understand it. Here she was, an educated woman with years of experience under her belt, and inside, she felt as rudderless as a college freshman. The pressure to discover her ideal life weighed heavily on her.
I put a lot of pressure on myself to make sure that I made the exact right decision.
Christine is not alone. Lots of people feel the way she did at one point or another, lost and stuck. Psychologists and self-help gurus have tried all kinds of different advice for people like Christine, but recently we heard a new idea from the tech world. It turns out that engineers and designers often face similar challenges when it comes to designing new products. How do you build something when you don't know what to build? Dave Evans used to work in Silicon Valley. One challenge he faced was in designing the Apple mouse.
Should we have one button on the mouse or two buttons on the mouse?
Dave said that he and Steve Jobs and the other engineers at Apple quickly realized they actually had two problems to solve.
Before you do problem solving, you have to do problem finding. What's the right thing to be working on?
The first challenge for the engineers was to figure out which kind of mouse users liked best. They built a couple of prototypes. Now, a prototype isn't just a model. It's a psychological tool.
We reveal the assumptions we make that are probably wrong. We get to, as we call it, sneak up on the future and involve other people with your ideas.
It turned out people preferred one button. Now, figuring out how to build a mouse with only one button was a complicated engineering problem. But at least now, the engineers knew where they were trying to go. This approach to innovation is called design thinking. A few years ago, Dave says he realized that design thinking might be useful outside the tech world too. He started teaching a course at Stanford University called Designing Your Life. In college, many students asked themselves a really big question. What should I do with my life?
When you can't know what you're doing, you can't navigate like a GPS would because you don't have a map and you don't have all the information, you have to wayfind. And wayfinding means taking one step at a time, knowing something about the direction you're going, trying a few things, tuning it up, and then doing it again and doing it again.
Dave's students often come to him saying they don't know what the right path is. He tells them,
there's more than one of you in there. So the problem with the current approach that lots of people are taking is it starts with the wrong question. And the wrong question is, how do I figure out that one best solution to my life? There is one exclusive, unique, optimal version of me, and I'm supposed to already know it, and I'm probably already late, and how do I figure it out, and how would I know if I knew? How can I be sure? And we think all those questions are the wrong questions.
So this is the guy Christine turned to for help. She went to a workshop Dave was running in New York. He asked her and the other participants to come up with three different paths they could realistically pursue.
Once you realize none of us knows the future, we're making it up as we go along, so let's get really good at making it up as we go along. In fact, let's design it as we go along. That turns out to work much more effectively.
Now, there are many things in our lives we just can't control, like Christine not being able to get a work visa or being laid off from her job. People often spend years feeling frustrated by their constraints. But Dave says, much of the time, these are gravity problems.
I happen to be a cyclist, and I'm getting older, so I'm doing that thing of putting on a little extra weight, and it's starting to bother me. So if I said, Shankar, I've got this terrible problem. It's gravity.
It might sound ridiculous, but Dave says,
a lot of people are, in fact, dealing with a problem that's just like gravity.
So let's say your problem is that you desperately want to be a musician, but you can't make any money doing that.
That's not a problem. That's a fact.
Dave says once you accept that fact, you can find ways to design your life around it. You can figure out how to live on much less money while being a rising, starving musician.
Or I could ask the question, since I'm never going to get to be a professional musician, how can I craft a lifestyle that keeps my income going while making my avocation, the thing I do for love, not money, called music, as satisfying as possible? That's a life I could design.
This is the heart of design thinking. It isn't about becoming your perfect self. It's about looking very honestly at your circumstances and asking what room you have to maneuver. Think about those designers in Silicon Valley. They're always releasing programs in beta. The idea is you try something very practical, something you can do quickly, send it out into the world, and then learn from how it performs. You come back, iterate, and then go back into the world again. As for Christine Metzger, she still doesn't have it all figured out. But she says this idea really helped her think about her problems differently.
In fact, I liked what he said about with design thinking, your goal is to fail early and often.
Fail early and often, and then try again. Shankar Vedantam, NPR News.
Shankar Vedantam is the host of the Hidden Brain podcast.
Support for Hidden Brain comes from Eli Lilly and Company. For 140 years, Lilly has been dedicated to uniting caring with discovery to make life better for people. Information on how the people of Lilly turn inspiration into action is at lillyforbetter.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And Morning Edition here for you every weekday from 5 until 9 on WPR. More news later on All Things Considered at 4 o'clock, and we'll have a check of the latest headlines from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio in just a moment. Classical music after that.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for WGTD comes from the staff of Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, who understand the holidays can seem hopeless, but there is hope, help, and support by texting HOPELINE to 741-741. Someone will listen or be a resource for you to give you help and hope. Text HOPELINE to 741-741.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.